welcome into a special podcast here on Sports Talk Chicago. True Stories Part 1, a conversation with Mark Doran. My name's John Zagluel, and across this three-part series, with episode 1 being today, I take a look at the local Chicago sports scene and talk to people who are making a difference in their respective communities. My three guests throughout this series all have significant stories to be told, and my goal is to have this podcast series serve as their outlet. Now, before we get started, make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at John Z Sports, and now on Facebook at John Zagluel. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest, and by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Celebrate the team's 20th anniversary season by purchasing tickets today. Call 708-489-2255 for your chance to be a part of history this summer in Crestwood. Now, going back to the interview for a moment, today's guest has had a storied career in baseball. He was a first-round draft pick and played in the MLB for multiple organizations. He's also starred in a box office hit and today prides himself on teaching the game the right way to those looking to make it to the next level. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, which is part one of the three-part series, and I appreciate all of your continued support. So sit back and relax and enjoy this candid conversation. It's now time for our special guest. He began his baseball career in 1980, starting as an outfielder at the University of Wisconsin, while also serving as a quarterback, defensive back, and kicker for the school's football team. By 1983, he had been named an All-American and was selected 23rd overall by the California Angels in the MLB draft. Through 8 seasons and 667 games in the minor leagues, he hit .270 while recording 48 outfield assists and making the Midwest League All-Star team. Today, he's an internationally renowned hitting instructor and the owner of Diamond Sports Academy. Please welcome Mark Doran to the show. Mark, how are you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, and hopefully we can get something going here where people understand a little bit about the game from the inside out.
Well, Mark, let's start today with a look back at your playing career, beginning collegiately at Wisconsin. Now, you were a multi-sport athlete. You played baseball and football for the Badgers. And with that in mind, how are you able to balance and excel in both of those commitments?
Well, you know, all my life as a kid, my father played. It was my goal. And you know what? My father used to always say to me, you know, I want you to be better than me. So everything I did was trying to be better than him. And I heard so many stories from his friends growing up. And we go back out to Iowa and listen to all of our his friends, family, relatives. Your father was the greatest at this, and he did this. And I hear all these stories, and I go, I'm going to be better. So I had to one-up him. So that was that kind of my motivation to do everything. And then the other thing is, another thing that motivated me, and it's kind of a little different than what we have now in this wonderful millennial generation, is my whole thing was, once I graduated from high school, I never wanted my parents to ever have to do anything for me again. I want to be in a situation where I was able to pay all my bills and do everything so they didn't have to financially take care of me and I wasn't a financial burden to them. And that was my goal. So I worked extra hard. I mean, my job in high school was to go to the school at, you know, 6 a.m. before classes and get my weightlifting in, get my running in, do whatever I did, then go to school. And after school, it was get my homework done as soon as I got home. And then I could do, you know, like maybe extra hitting, or I had a blanket set up on a clothesline in my basement where I would throw footballs into. I'd throw baseballs into. I would punt into it. I would kick into it. So I did all those kinds of things to give myself that extra edge. And when I tell my sons that now, they like laugh like, yeah, right. Well, then when my mom comes into town and I'm like, hey, look at Turner's on the damn computer again playing Fortnite. And she goes, yeah, when your dad was your age, he was down in the basement hitting balls into a blanket, driving me nuts, or he's kicking balls into a blanket or something. And it was bump, bump, bump. That's all I heard every night. So it's a completely different generation we have now.
And what's interesting about your athletic career is that, of course, you know, you were an All-American, a first-round MLB draft pick, and you're predominantly known as this hitting guru in the baseball world, but you did finish top 10 in the Big Ten Conference in scoring as a kicker. And you made some high-pressure kicks, including one against number one-ranked Michigan. Was there an opportunity for you to pursue kicking at the next level? And if so, did you ever consider it?
Yeah, there was, but I had a really bad injury in football. I had a compound fracture in my right leg, which was my kicking leg, and tore up my knee a little bit. And that kind of started a little bit of the problems I had when I got into pro baseball. And that kind of changed my mind. I said, you know what? Heck with it. I'm done with football. I got to stick with baseball. And really what changed that whole scenario too was when I was laying in my hospital bed after I had surgery to put metal rods in my leg, the doctor came in and said, I just got 26 phone calls from Major League Baseball teams wondering if you're going to be ready for the spring. So at that point I was like, wow, I think I better be sticking with my baseball now. So that, and I, you know, afterwards it was kind of really wild, because when I got out of the hospital, you know, everybody wanted me to come to the football offices. So I came to the football offices, and Coach Dave McClain, who was our head football coach at the time, said, hey, come on and talk to me in the office. And when I went into his office, he pretty much said, you're done as a football player here. And I was like, what do you mean, coach? You know, and he's like, you're done as a football player, son. I mean, there's 26 major league clubs that are calling about you. You're going to have a chance of playing Major League Baseball. You've got to go that route. I mean, and he said, I tried my best to kind of protect you, and this is what happened. So now I don't want to ruin your chance to be a Major League Baseball player. So, I mean, I really appreciated that from him, and it's something that kind of chokes me up a little bit when I think about it. But, you know, it was something that it's pretty cool, you know, that he really thought about my life in the future for me, and he really understood everything. So it's kind of a neat story if you think about it.
Mark Doran here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Mark, you mentioned about all the phone calls and everything. You ended up taking the MLB route. You were selected 23rd overall, first round of the MLB draft in 1983 to the California Angels. So take me through what went on throughout that day and the process of being drafted. And secondly, how much did it mean to you to achieve that lifelong dream of becoming an official MLB prospect?
Well, I can tell you this. Back then, it was a big difference compared to the way it is now, okay? If you look at how much money signing bonuses were and everything else, I can tell you this. I found out that I was drafted 23rd, okay? I was sitting on my couch, okay, in Madison, Wisconsin, eating scrambled eggs and bacon, okay, getting ready to go to the football offices, and I was going to go in and I was going to work out and everything else. And actually, a buddy of mine who just left here, who was here visiting me, he was sitting with me, and we ended up heading right straight to our local bar right on the corner from our apartment, having a few to celebrate at like 11 o'clock in the morning. So we ended up having some swamp waters at the college club in Madison, Wisconsin. That's kind of how I found out that I was drafted in there, because I got a phone call at like 11:30 in the morning, you know. So it was pretty amazing. It was a surprise to me, because I had inklings that I was going to be drafted. But I had no, it wasn't like it is today. Everybody kind of knows, man, because they got all this stuff going on, and ESPN and Fox, and everybody has to know what's going on. Back in our day, it was like, hey, dude, you got drafted. Wow, geez, really? Thanks, cool, you know? So it was kind of a fun time. It was such a surprise. That's what, I guess, it was just a surprise, because they don't do things like they do now. Like, most of the kids know where they're going to go now. We had no idea back then.
What'd you do after you found out that you got drafted while you were at the bar with your friend?
Got really drunk. No, to be honest with you. We had a couple of celebratory drinks, and then I had to go. I mean, I had to go, because everybody was bugging me at the bar, and I was afraid I was going to get annihilated. But I had to hurry up and get things together. I had to go home and see my parents and talk to them about everything and then start getting things organized and ready to go. And that's pretty much what I did. I said, hey, Pete, we got to get going, man. I got to get out of here. And we hurried up, went back, packed up a suitcase of clothes and everything else. Because, I mean, actually what happened to me was this happened so fast. The next day, the scout who signed me was coming in. We're negotiating bonus and all this stuff. And so I had to go home, get everything organized, get ready to go. And then I had to have my buddy Pete pack up all my stuff at the apartment back in Madison and bring it back for me because we negotiated for 2 days. Boom, signed my contract. Bam, I'm gone. I'm in Anaheim, California. And we're at Cal State Fullerton for rookie workouts and getting ready to go. That's how fast it happened. So I really didn't have a lot of time to kind of go, oh, this is really cool and have a good time and everything. You know, it was just like bam, bam, bam. Like now they've got all the ceremony and the pomp and everything else. We didn't have that. It was just like, hey, you're signed. Your plane ticket will be there tomorrow. Boom, you're gone. You're on a plane. You're there. And let's get her done.
So you get drafted by the Angels. You start your professional career at Single-A Peoria. And in your first season, you hit just .222 in 69 games. You obviously weren't yourself, playing under the pressure of being a first-round pick. What caused you to struggle during your first professional season? And then how did you recover by year two?
Well, my first year I went in, and because I had a broken leg in from football, I was having a lot of problems with my right leg. I had stress fractures happening in my leg. And my knee was bothering me. My right knee was bothering me a lot. So I was struggling with a lot of pain in my right leg. Well, I'm a right-handed hitter, so my right leg was my push-off leg when I was hitting. Struggling, pushing off, and getting a lot of leg drive and everything else. Plus, you know, I was playing in the Midwest League. A lot of the guys there had 2-3 years of, you know, professional baseball experience. I'm coming in. I'm feeling my way through, not feeling 100%. And as the season went on, my leg started kind of really getting beat up and banged up and everything else. And so I that was more or less just kind of a get your feet wet kind of a season for me. And I was learning, and I was learning how to play baseball. We didn't have a very good team there at the time. I think the Angels had just fired the coach there for some reason, the manager there. And I ended up going there with Joe Coleman, who was a pitcher, and he was a pitching coach. And when I mean, going in there with Joe, it was like, hey, just hustle, play hard, get your work done. Okay, go out there. And he, you know, and so there wasn't a lot of instruction there or anything. So everything I did there was trying to find how to play on my own. And I think the Angels did that. I was with, Wally Joyner was there, Billy Merrifield. So we had our first, second, third draft choices were all there. And those guys didn't do that great either. So we all kind of struggled in the environment that was there. It was a losing environment. It wasn't really, you know, a very good environment at first. And so it was kind of just get your feet wet, here you go, and go from there.
Now, as I had mentioned, you had recovered. You ended up making the Major League roster for both the Angels and the White Sox. But before that time, you had logged 667 games in the minor leagues, a lengthy stint in the minors. So with that kind of career and that track record, what are your impressions on the current lawsuit involving workers' rights between the MILB and former players? Any thoughts on what the former players are saying to minor league baseball about working conditions and problems?
Well, you know, like back when I played, I mean, here, we're playing in, I'll never forget it. We're in Waterloo, Iowa. Okay? We're in Waterloo, Iowa. We're playing the first night game. Okay? So we play there. And after the game, we go in to get in the showers. Go in the showers. Now, it's the first time I've ever been in a stadium in Waterloo, Iowa. Walk into the showers, and the showers are all about 4 feet off the ground. The showers are underneath. Now, imagine this here. They're underneath, and the angle of the roof is the angle of the stands. The shower head is 4 feet off the ground. And because it was so nasty and the drainage was so bad, you're standing on wooden pallets.
Oh, my goodness.
You're on wooden pallets because they didn't want you in that scummy, soapy, nasty water. Now, you've got these shower heads that are spitting on you. and it feels like they're shooting bullets at you and they're bouncing off you and you're trying to take a shower, okay? And we just got done playing on a field that I think they had the county fair on, and they had the cattle and the horses all out there because the outfield had footprints in it, and the ball would come bouncing off at the outfield like it was hitting off of cow pies or something like that. And it was like playing on a damn pinball machine. Okay, now imagine, now those are the working conditions I played under. Now, my brother-in-law was recently a coach in the Texas Rangers organization, just retired a couple years ago. But I was with him, and we were in Frisco and Round Rock, and we walk into these clubhouses, and these guys have beautiful carpeting and couches and TVs and a snack room with Muscle Milk and food and everything else, and these guys have it made. Now, our food was the leftover friggin' hot dogs that they had from the concession stand, stale popcorn from maybe the night before, okay? So now, working conditions and all this garbage. Now these guys are complaining in the minor leagues who are making, I was making $650 a month, okay? $650 a month. Now, the one thing I do have to say is I just found out that, like, average now, there's guys in A-ball averaging $850 a month in 2018, 2019. And I was making $650 a month back in 1983, 1984. So that's kind of crazy. In my book, that's nuts. And I do like the way they take care of the players as far as their nutrition now and everything else. But I think they need to start giving these kids some better meal money. They need to give them better salaries. You look at how much money they're spending on a couple of guys that are two-tool players, like a Harper and a Machado. And it's funny because in my place, I got a bunch of big league guys coming in here all the time. We talk about this and, you know, guys from our era. And it's amazing how two-tool players getting $350 million, $300 million, you know, it's crazy. So if you can spend that much money on that guy, how come you can't funnel some of this money? Because they're making billions off of licensing and everything else. Why can't you funnel it down to your future? Why are you going to pay a guy $350 million when you could take a guy who's a stud in your organization and build him up to be that guy and you pay him less? It's crazy how I thought these guys are supposed to be good business people. But they're getting goofy, man. They're getting goofy.
Well, let's move now to your time in the major leagues, getting away from that minor league topic. And as I mentioned, you played for both the Angels and the White Sox in the late 80s and the early 90s. Starting with your time in California, tell me about an assistant coach that you played under at the time in Joe Maddon, now manager for the Cubs. What was Joe like when you played for him for the Angels back in the 80s and 90s?
See, that's the thing. Joe was actually my first full season, he was my manager in Peoria, my first full season. Now, remember what I said, my first year, my first half season where I hit 222 and there was no teaching going on and everything else. Well, I met Joe. Joe was an instructor in instructional league that year in 1983, in the fall of 1983. And then Joe became the manager of the Peoria Chiefs. Now, they went from the Suns, which was kind of like some company from out in Baltimore, because there was the Orioles had a team that was the Suns out east, and they had bought the franchise in Peoria, Illinois, because they just started there. Well, Pete Vanocken bought the Peoria franchise and turned them into the Peoria Chiefs, as the old Peoria Chiefs from the 40s and 30s, I guess. And so that went into like a big time situation because Pete demanded, don't be giving me scrubs. I don't want a bunch of turds. You know, I want a quality team that's going to give us a chance to win the league. And I want a quality manager. I want quality people, because I'm going to show you how I can run a quality organization. So I had Joe Maddon there, and Joe talked to us. He scolded us when we were bad boys. Joe was incredible. I mean, Joe is like my brother. As a matter of fact, I texted him yesterday for opening day, and right away he texts me back, you know, like, hey, thanks, you know, I appreciate that you care. And I'm like, you know, how the heck can I not care? You know, and it's just things like that. He's still that way with all of us. Joe's just an incredible human being. He's a great players coach. He's a teacher. He wants to teach all the time. And that's what kind of like, if you saw like after last season, he made a comment that I kind of let the team down because I need to get back to being a teacher. And he's one of those coaches too that he doesn't say this is my philosophy. He says this is my philosophy. Can this work for you? And what do you do that works that might be away from my philosophy? So he's very understanding. He wants to talk the game. Over the years, I had Joe for 8 years as a coach. Some type of, he was very influential on me. And I had him for 8 years as a manager, as a hitting coach, as a field coordinator, as a total mentor, as an ass chewer. You know what I mean? So I had him in every aspect. I had him as my guy where, like, I had a problem with a AAA manager, okay? And the AAA manager was trying to make everything out to be my fault, okay? And I had the backing of the whole team. The team was behind me. I was, even though it was like my first year in AAA, these guys like Kirk McCaskill and Jack Lazorco, guys that had Daryl Miller, guys who had years in the big leagues, you know, and were guys that were, you know, 3-4 years in AAA in the big leagues and things like that. These guys were coming to me, dude, you're a leader of our team. You're a fire plug of our team. And my AAA manager, whose name I refuse to ever say again because I might kill him. But anyway, he knows who I'm talking about. So, you know, I kind of busted a door down and kind of was going to drag him over a desk and kill him, but I stopped. But Joe was my middleman, and I talked to Joe, and Joe understood where I was coming from. And then Joe kind of like did his detective work and found out that the guy was a bad, bad man. You know what I mean? And it wasn't my fault. Here's something that's really close to me, too, is about Joe Maddon. When my sons came to a ball game with me and we sat down in the dugout with Joe Maddon, Joe grabbed my boys and grabbed them around the necks and said, he didn't have to do this. He grabbed them around the necks and he said, listen, your father was one of my favorite players because I always knew where he stood. I always knew he was going to kill himself to win a game and do whatever I asked him to do. Okay. And just remember that. And, you know, it's something else that, you know, that rings home a lot. And when your kids hear that, and when you're trying to tell them that, hey, this is the kind of player I was, and they look at you like, yeah, right, Dad. You're just saying this because you want me to be that way. But I played with everything I had every day. And that's kind of where I kind of struggled in my professional career because I played baseball. And Joe used to say this to me all the time. He's like, dude, you're not playing football. You know, you got to calm down, man. You got to get under control more. You can't run through a wall. You're going to get hurt. But I played baseball like I played football. The only problem was is you play 162 games, and then you go and play winter ball, and you're playing that much. You get the heck beat out of you, you know, because baseball's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Well, I played baseball like it was a sprint. And that kind of, if you look at my numbers and you look at how many stints I had on the DL, that's what kind of hurt me from getting to the big leagues. Because I beat the heck out of myself. I was that kind of a player.
Well, let's go now. Speaking of Chicago baseball and Joe Maddon, going back to your time with the White Sox, mm-hmm. You ended up going to them after the Angels. What did it mean to you to return to Chicago and play for your hometown team like you did?
You know what? That was a lot of fun, too. And playing for the White Sox, when I came over to the White Sox, I got to play with Robin Ventura and Frank Thomas, and that was an absolute... I mean, at the time, it was an absolute godsend for me because I was so soured because of my AAA experience with Tom. I can't say that guy's name. But anyway, with my AAA manager with the Angels for a couple years, I was really soured on baseball, and I really didn't like it that much. I was doing it because it paid the bills, and I enjoyed playing baseball. I just didn't like people in baseball. I didn't like to talk to people in baseball. I didn't trust any coaches or anything else. And then when I got traded over to the White Sox, it was like a breath of fresh air. My hitting coach with the White Sox was Ron Jackson. Ron Jackson played for the Angels. I knew him from spring trainings with the Angels. So all of a sudden that clicked with us. And being able to sit in the dugout or being able to sit in the clubhouse or being able to sit in the batting cages and talk with Papa Jack and talk to him about the things that happened to me with the Angels, and having a guy that was with the Angels and he saw some of the same things. So now all of a sudden I've got a guy there that understands the garbage that was going on. You know what I mean? And so all of a sudden that became very comfortable. And then playing with Ventura and Frank Thomas and those guys, and heck, we had Craig Graybeck, Richie Amaral, Matt Murillo, Wilson Alvarez, Wayne Edwards. We had all these guys that were, you know, ended up being very good players for the White Sox in the big leagues. And when I came in there, it was like I was like the piece that they needed, because they were all good guys and they were all kind of quiet guys. And then here I come in, you know, busting doors down. I want to kill people. You know what I mean? So and when the season was over with and we won a championship, they're all going, dang, man, it was awesome, man. We're so glad we got you, because you turned everything, you turned us into badasses. And you know what? That is another moment in your life, you know, that you have certain, I guess, epiphanies or whatever you want to call it. You have certain times in your life where you never forget those, and they're like very, I guess, life-changing, and they're really important to you. That's another one of the things, you know, being able to play for the White Sox and doing that and just being around those guys too, and getting the love of baseball again, getting that back.
Going back to the love of baseball and what you talked about with your AAA manager, who will stay unnamed during this podcast, do you agree with the idea that for some kids today playing high school or college ball, that one bad coach could truly ruin their experience playing baseball for the rest of their lives? Is that something that you believe in based on your experience with that manager?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I see it all the time. And you know what? Maybe I'm one of those guys. I don't know. I don't think I've ever been that way, because I think I'm pretty fair with all the kids that I've coached over the years. And I've had pretty much I've had a lot of success, you know, with Olympians and major leaguers and everything else that I've trained and kids that I've coached. And, you know, it's kind of funny, like right now, the organization Upper Deck Cougars that I'm involved with, you know, I think about 80% of the coaches are guys that I've trained, and they went on and played pro ball and were extremely, you know, gifted athletes and did great in college and things like that. So, I've seen it, though. I've seen kids want to quit, and I've had to talk kids off the ledge and bring them back, and all of a sudden the kids do a great job. So yes, I mean, coaches, here's where I really think there's a big problem today, is because of the internet generation, everybody thinks they're going to be an internet superstar and get a lot of hits on their websites and make a lot of money on their YouTube videos and everything else. And people are trying to make money off of the innocence of people who don't know anything about the game. So if you have a cool website, or you have cool uniforms on your team, and you walk around like you're a big shot, even though you've never, you know, I mean, there's so many guys out there coaching now that couldn't hit water if they fell from a boat. They can't hit a fungo to their teams, so they have somebody else hit ground balls, and they walk around yelling and screaming at kids. They see it all the time. Or they walk around and, you know, they're talking to us on the field. Oh, yeah, we got this kid and this kid and these three kids are going to Kansas State, Kansas, Wichita State. You know, and we got 8 D1 commits. Then our team of turds goes out on the field and beats them 12-0. And, I mean, you've been there. You've seen us. You know, we get all these superstar teams. And these guys aren't there for the kids. You know, they're not there to develop. They're there to go out and pluck good players and brag about how, you know, and you should come to our team so I can make thousands of dollars. And there's no development. So it's all about, you know, it's all about the Benjamins, man.
So after your time with the Sox in the early 90s, your baseball playing career ended. And I know that must have been difficult to retire, step away from the game. But despite that, it turns out that you didn't stray far away from Major League Baseball, as you were cast to be Henry Rowengartner's catcher in the box office hit Rookie of the Year. I'd love to know about the entire experience. What was filming like? How was working with Gary Busey? And was the plot believable to you at the time, with the Cubs making it to the World Series?
Well, number one, is hanging out with Gary Busey's X-rated, so we can't go there. filming the movie is a pain in the butt because you're out there on the set. I had to be out there on the set from like 7 in the morning till 1 in the morning because what I did was I was a principal actor, so I had to be in all of my acting scenes, but I also had to do tech advising stuff where all the scenes that the Cubs actors did and Rowan Gardner did and Busey did, and I mean, I had to be involved with all of that stuff. So, I mean, it was long hours, but the money was sweet, okay? I do have to say that, all right? But filming a movie, when you look at it, like we were all of us baseball guys that were doing this, when you're looking at those movies, you're going, oh, my God, this is horrible. The way they set up scenes, you're going, no, you can't set up that scene like that. You got to do it this way. And they go, no, you can't do it that way because of the angle of the camera or whatever. So they know. But you're looking at them going, you guys are idiots. But they know exactly how to film it. You know, because they know how the angles, how the cameras shoot and all that stuff. So, but at first, you're looking at it and you're going, this is a joke. This is going to be so stupid. This is ridiculous. But you know what's amazing? Is like right now, okay, I can tell you this just last week. There's kids that are like 10, 11 years old telling me, now this movie was done. We were done in 1994. There's kids now that are 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. That's my favorite movie. I love watching. I didn't know you were the catcher. Seriously. I mean, it's amazing how long that movie has kind of really transcended baseball and everything. But with the Cubs having success and winning the World Series, it really jumped in because now it's more believable. See, and that was a funny part is when we were on the set and the producers and the director and everybody were saying, you know, hey, this is definitely a fantasy movie. Cubs winning the World Series. You know what I mean? But now that the Cubs have won the World Series and the Cubs are competitive all the time, now all of a sudden everybody keeps looking back at that as, wow, that's... And they think it's like a movie from now. You know what I mean? Right. So it's kind of really... It's cool that we did it because it's transcended so many years and now it's really in the, I guess you would say, the motif of today's Cubs baseball.
Well, let's shift gears now to your time as a hitting instructor and the philosophies that you teach versus what's considered popular today, as we talked about before with the internet age and coaches thinking that they know what they're doing. And more specifically, I want to get your thoughts on the so-called launch angle revolution. Lots of young players today are being taught to uppercut when swinging to lift the ball in the air on purpose. It's well documented in Major League Baseball as well. Where do you stand on the launch angle movement, and how does it compare to what you teach to those who come to you?
Okay, the first thing is this. Okay, I can kind of give you a little synopsis of like my personal experience as a player and then kind of pass it on to the theories of a lot of people, okay? When I was a high school player, okay, I was brought up to the varsity baseball team as a freshman. I was 5'8", 145 pounds, okay? I just wanted to get the bat on the ball consistently. You know, I was a young freshman, okay? And so I just wanted to hit the ball hard consistently. I wasn't worried about home runs or launch angles or anything else because I was a small little guy. I just wanted to, you know, compete and be able to play. Then as I grew older, okay, all of a sudden, you know, I became my sophomore year. I was a really good line drive hitter, and I was a little bit bigger. You know, I was like 5'10", you know, 160 pounds my sophomore year. Then my junior year, I was 6'1", 175, 180, and I hit 3 home runs. But they were line drives that went out. Then my senior year of high school, I was 6'2", 205, and I had been in the weight room now for 4 years. And now I hit a lot more home runs, okay? But I was always trying to hit line drives. So what's the difference between my freshman year, my sophomore year, my junior year, compared to my senior year? Well, I had double-digit home runs when I was a senior, and the most I ever hit was like 3. What happened? Well, I was hitting line drives at 6'2", 205. So they weren't hitting off the fence or bouncing in front of the fence. They were going over the fence. So now my line drives were 350-foot line drives. They weren't 300-foot line drives. So... Strength, right? what drives me nuts today about this launch angle stuff, they look at Aaron Judge. Okay? Tell me, what's Aaron Judge's size? I've got pictures of Aaron Judge hitting balls off his back hip with his head looking out at the pitcher, his front foot wide open, he's leaning on his back leg, and he's hitting a home run to right field in Yankee Stadium. Okay? How many young kids today can do that? Aaron Judge got to where he was because he was a good hitter in grade school, high school, all the way up. Now as he matured, got bigger, got stronger, got better, starts hit home runs. And he can do things that no normal human being can do because of his size. And you're talking about a guy who's that big and filled with fast twitch. Most guys that big don't have the fast twitch that he has. You know, most guys are those big slob linemen in the NFL. You know what I mean? Think about right. it, though. They're slow twitch. They're just big, powerful guys. This guy is he's just an anomaly. This guy is fast twitch, huge, and can get away with murder, okay? Then you got a guy like Josh Donaldson preaching launch angle. Oh, I'm going for the top of the cage. But when you watch Josh Donaldson swing the bat, when he's hitting home runs, he's not swinging up until after he hits the ball and he knows he got it. Then all of a sudden he leans back and lifts up and finishes high and says, oh, that's my launch angle swing. But on the other side of it, you look at the guy with the flattest swing in the major leagues was the home run champion. Stanton's got the flattest swing in the major leagues, and he wins the home run title. So who's peddling what here? You know what I mean?
Right.
Now, you talk to the greats, and you talk to the Carews, and you talk to, you know, a guy like Jim Thome, who talks about, I tried to work on flattening my swing out. If I would have been able to flatten my swing out more, I wouldn't be the leading strikeout man in the history of Major League Baseball. You know what I mean? And he's talking about, he doesn't call it launch angle. He says, hey, you square the ball up, you hit it hard somewhere. Sometimes you hit it up, sometimes you hit it down. So what are they going to call it? Negative launch angle when you hit a hard ground ball through the infield because you don't hit the bottom half of the ball? It's not launch angle, it's exit angle. And I love that terminology because think about it. If a major league hitter like an Aaron Judge has 250 hits, right? And he's got 40 home runs, okay? What's the percentage there?
Like 20%, nothing much.
Okay, so right. when you think about it in those terms, okay, a majority of his balls aren't going out, a majority of his hits are not going out at the perfect launch angle. So it's just based on how you hit and how strong you are. And that's what's kind of funny about a lot of this stuff. These guys start making up stuff because they want to sell something on the internet. And then they start talking about how do you get launch angle? How do you do all these things? Well, this is how your body has to work to get the optimum launch angle. Well, we're going to do this in 2/2 hundredths of a second. You're going to be able to do all these launch angle movements in 2/2 hundredths of a second. Huh? See, to me, that's physically impossible. And to a lot of the greats, you know, I was like a couple weeks ago, I was sitting with Juan Samuel. And I said, hey, Juan, what do you think about the launch angle stuff? He goes, dude, all I know is when I was facing somebody throwing 95, 98 miles an hour, I wasn't trying to get launch angle. I was trying to stay on top of the ball so I could barrel that ball up, and I wasn't looping my barrel. Because I've seen it in the minor leagues now for a lot of years coaching, all these guys trying to lift the ball, and they just get blown away with good fastballs. That's why the pitching has changed in the big leagues. Pitchers are going up and down in the zone. They're looking for pitchers now that are 6'8", 6'6", that throw a riding fastball, they call it. All it is a fastball that they keep up at the top of the zone, and they're throwing 98 miles an hour, 95 to 98 miles an hour, and they can keep it up at the top of the zone, and it doesn't go down. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for those big guys that can throw up in the zone.
Well, let's now go to the game itself, Major League Baseball. It's undergoing some modernization and change. Right now, pitch clocks are being implemented in the minor leagues. There's talks that they're going to come to the majors very soon. There have also been talks of automating the strike zone and ending umpire discretion. Where do you stand on both of those issues? and what effects do you see them having on the game in the future?
Okay, here's the way we and myself, and I've talked to a bunch of veterans, okay? Back when we played, the umpires called balls and strikes, and they called outs and safes and did all that stuff, right? And when us players made an error, we made an error, okay? So now, what are we going to do now? Then why don't we get rid of the players, too, and put robots out there that don't make errors, okay? One of the best parts about baseball, okay, and what made it go faster, if you think about it, was what? The human element. The human element. You let the umpires make the call. If the call's botched, here comes the coach out, argues for a little bit. He says, dude, you had enough. You know, I might have missed it. I might not. You know, here, when I was playing, I'll never forget this. You know, one time I got all over an umpire about making some bad calls, and he ripped off his mask and yelled at me, and it was like, damn it, don't you think I can have a bad day too? I don't get on you when you're 0 for 4 with 4 strikeouts. You don't get on me when I'm having a bad day. And what can you say to that? So everybody has bad days. Humans are playing the game. Let humans umpire the game. But the problem is now we got to have 9 million camera angles. So now umpires are getting critiqued on super duper slow motion, where you've got a camera that's shooting 1,500 frames per second. Oh, he missed that call. Jesus Christ. It just happened in a fraction of a second. So you're going to rip on this poor guy. You know what I mean? I say we get rid of all the reviews and all this garbage, and let's make the game human again. Let's take it back to the good old days. Because then people are going to have more fun. Forget about showing all the replays. Don't embarrass people. Because think about it. Think about this. If all the people in the real world, all these GMs, why don't we come out and we report on all the stupid things that these GMs do? All the bad draft choices. All the horrible, god-awful mistakes. Let's embarrass the crap out of all the GMs. See, and then let's see. Let's go to somebody's job, some fan's job, right? And when they mess up, here's a replay of you being an absolute moron, you idiot, and just rip them. How would everybody feel? So, yes, I've had my share of arguments with umpires. And you know what? Nowadays, I really can't blame Major League umpires for really getting an attitude. Because, think about it. There's like 1,200 friggin' cameras on them every play. And then if they mess up, it just gets blown up in the press and everything else. So think about it. How would you feel like that? Think about it. I want to ask any fan out there, how would you feel if you had 1,500 cameras or 1,200 cameras or whatever they got in a major league game now, shooting at every angle of you, everything you did? So every time you picked your nose or whatever, you were getting critiqued. Seriously. You know what I mean?
Right.
Cripes, these poor umpires nowadays, it's like they're getting anal probed every call. That's ridiculous, man. It's crazy. But you know what I mean? Players make an error. Why can't the umpires make an error? And a lot of times when the umpires did make an error, back when I played, they said, dude, I screwed up. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. You know what I mean? They were honest with you. And then how can you argue with somebody who's, hey, honestly, this is what I thought I saw. I might have messed up. Or, man, I thought I saw this, but I messed up. You know what I mean? It's human. That's human. Now we don't have the dun, 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 dun. Let's check out this replay for 20 minutes. You know what I mean? Like
right.
The NFL. It's a joke. Just let them play. The guy makes a call. Right?
Right. And that also contributes to, which I was going to ask you next, the pace of play problem. Because the MLB's putting in all of these pitch clocks and all these other things to try and speed up the games. So your argument is, get rid of replay, have it go back to basics, and there wouldn't even be a problem.
No. Games speed it up again. We get games going again. How come we didn't have these problems back when I played? Okay? And everybody's looking. I mean, because you have all these replays on them, what do all the players do now?
Look right to the scoreboard.
Right away.
Yep.
So now they're standing out there, they're looking around, looking at the scoreboard, waiting for the replay to come up. Okay, then now I'll go throw the pitch. Pitcher thinks he threw a strike. The umpire called it a ball. He's looking up at the scoreboard again. oh, that's there. And then he turns around, he's got an ad. So we're waiting for all this instant gratification on the scoreboard and everything and all this replay crap. That's going to cut out a ton of time. Okay? Here's the other thing. Okay? You are told in these TV games, which is every game's a TV game now. Okay? You're told that you, instead of having 8 pitches, you just keep going until I go here. Well, what's causing that? Commercials.
Yeah, commercials.
We got 10 commercials between innings. Think about, see? Now, you start, when you start thinking about that, wow, you know, I never really thought of that. I remember as a kid watching a Cubs game or a Sox game, and you had Harry Carey or Jack Brickhouse, hey, have an old style. Hey, have a Falstaff. And that was a commercial in between innings, and they showed Wilbur Wood warming up or Fergie Jenkins warming up. And boom, here we're back to baseball. Now, you got 10 commercials. So now, in between innings, is stretched out from 8 pitcher goes out and throws his 8 pitches, and let's get her going to, hey, we got to wait till the TV guy says, hey, have at it. Now, see, they don't go into that. Why? Why don't they go into that?
Because it's all about money.
It's revenue. There it is. It's the revenues.
Right.
So if you're going to complain about time, let's cut all the crap on the scoreboard, the guys watching replays, and let's cut back on the commercials in between innings or whatever, and do like they did in the old days. You want to do a commercial in between batters? Have your radio guy, your TV guy, hey. Right? How many times do you see a Cubs announcer do a commercial? Harry Carey and Jack Brickhouse did it all the time. Wow. Now, people don't think about those things, do they? But during the game, you got, you know, whatever. You know, hey, I'm sitting here, you know, having Borden ice cream sandwiches here at the ballpark. Or, you know, seriously, you know, Ballpark Franks. Oh, man, they plump when you cook. They're doing those during the game.
And, Mark, before we let you go today, going back to your time as a major leaguer, who was the toughest pitcher that you faced as a batter, and also who was the pitcher that you looked forward to facing the most?
Well, through my career, the guy who just absolutely owned me was Tim Cruz, who died in a boating accident when he was in a boating accident with Bobby Ojeda. Tim Cruz owned me. I just seemed like that guy. He'd throw me a stinking slider when I thought he was going to throw me a sinker, and he threw me a sinker when I thought he was going to throw me a slider, and he just, everything looked the same. Everything came out of the same arm slot. Everything looked the same to me. I couldn't pick up his pitches at all. And then the guy who I loved hitting against, and today it was funny because a local guy who does, you know, Tim Kunis, who does the home plates, Barnwood Builders, he does the home plates, baseball stuff and everything else, and the USA stuff. He was at the ABC convention down in Texas this year and selling his things, and he met Dennis Cook. Dennis Cook, the lefty reliever from the Giants and the Mets, who had a great career out of the University of Texas. I just owned Dennis. I mean, I just loved hitting against him. I mean, I hit a bunch of home runs off him. I think I might have been like 11 for 13 off the guy with like 7 home runs. I mean, I just owned the dude. And I mean, when I came up, when he warmed up in the bullpen, I knew I was hitting. If I wasn't playing, I was pinch hitting if he was warming up in the bullpen. So it was kind of cool, you know. And it's funny, when Timmy saw him down at the convention, right away, he put it on his Facebook page. Oh, I'm here with, you know, former major leaguer Dennis Cook. He's going to buy a plate. So I sent him, hey, tell Dennis Mark Dorn said hi, and I own you, Cookie. And he said, and it was kind of a nice exchange. So it was pretty cool.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it, and hope to have you on again soon. Great interview. Thank you for the time.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a lot of fun talking about baseball and talking about, you know, hopefully getting people's heads going in the right direction for the future. You know, baseball is such a great game, and I just think right now we're in a bad time, to be honest with you, where money's controlling too much. We're losing a lot of the great baseball people. I mean, there's a lot of people in baseball that shouldn't be. And it's going away from, the game is kind of going away from baseball people running baseball and business people who think they know baseball running it. The thing about it is, I think that trend is about to start turning back to baseball people. As you look at, like, when the Red Sox made a lot of statements after they won the World Series about how, you know, we went away from all the new analytics and everything else, and we're going back to old school baseball, that it is kind of helped by analytics. And that's what it should be. And I've got, like, a very good friend of mine who is the guy, probably one of the guys who's the architect of analytics back in 1979 with Tony La Russa and Dave Duncan. He talks about that all the time, how the new age analytics people are trying to make it more about them than the players and the game itself. And that's when things start going bad. You know what I mean? This game's been played for a lot of years, and you ain't going to come in because you think you're smarter than it, because you went to Harvard or Yale and you're an arrogant Ivy Leaguer, and you're not gonna come in and control everything, even though you couldn't hit water if you fell from a boat. So just remember that out there, folks. This game is a lot harder than it looks. There's just great people that make it look real easy.
What an honor it was to welcome Mark Doran on the podcast as we talked with him about his amazing journey to the major leagues, his thoughts on some new age hitting philosophies, and also his takes on some MLB rule changes. And on a personal note, this interview was one of the most enjoyable ones that I've ever conducted. As you heard, Mark is so candid, he's so open about his experiences, and he's not afraid to ruffle a few feathers if he deems it necessary. So I truly hope you enjoyed this interview just as much as I did. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Chi-Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at John Z Sports, and now on Facebook at John Zagluel. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription box on the homepage of the site. Simply type in your email, click yes on the confirmation email, and from there, you'll be subscribed. You'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. And remember, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago, and every podcast from the 2018-19 calendar year is now available. Feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and or write a review. Your support is greatly appreciated. And finally, if you enjoy today's podcast, make sure to check out my new radio show every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. You'll still hear my same hard-hitting Chicago sports opinions. Plus, we'll cover national sports issues, introduce special segments, and of course, welcome special guests on every show. Again, that's every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. Thank you again for listening to today's show, and have a great day.